Lenny Curry's political committee gets scammed by what his team calls a complex international scheme. Two new Jacksonville City Council councilors chosen by Rick Scott sworn in. Residency issues for one of them, there will be a lawsuit. Meanwhile, another lawsuit for a special election. Confederate monument discussion stalled out last year. Is it time to reopen it? Body cameras not being used by the JSO right now with the pause for procurement. Should residents be concerned? And Al Lawson brings Nancy Pelosi to Jacksonville as a congressional race with Alvin Brown heats up. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning and thanks for listening. I'm A.G. Gankarski, in again from Melissa Ross, and we are live from Studio 5 for First Coast Connect this Friday the 13th. Just ahead, we'll hear about a busy week in the news with our weekly roundtable. None of them wearing hockey masks, should be noted. We'll take your calls at 549-2937 this action-packed day, then later a live in-studio performance by Big Banders, Crescendo Amelia. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and time for our weekly media roundtables. We welcome the Big Four. Florida Times Union reporter Tessa Duvall. Tessa, welcome.
Hey, good morning.
WJCT contributor Fred Matthews. Fred?
Good morning, AG.
Daily Record reporter Dangerous Dave Cotton. Dave.
Oh, hey, everybody. Hey.
And last and not least, WJCT reporter Ryan Bank. Ryan,
good morning.
How are you? All right, great to see you. Let's kick things off. Scam Something That Lasts. That's our first segment. Got bad news for Lenny Curry via the Florida Times Union. They reported that Curry's Build Something to Last political committee was $120,000 poorer after his treasurer wired money to four different addresses across the country at the behest of a political consultant. Turned out a phone scammer duped the treasurer, who didn't figure out the hustle until he was called up when he was on the phone with the scammer. Apparently, the treasurer doesn't have caller ID. The fundraiser's computer was hacked off Nigeria. The phone hoaxer was in Luxembourg, so it's, you know, adding to the mystery. And how this was resolved, the treasurer donated to another political committee that then gave the money back to Curry's committee. Will donors care? Probably not. Curry brought in $244,000 in June, with four opponents raising just over $1,500 against him. But what do y'all think? Call 549-2937. We want to get the panel in. Dave Cotton, let's start with you. Should donors be concerned?
This is certainly an interesting case. I don't think I've ever heard of political action committee being targeted like this. And I think it would be a question if I'm donating to this campaign or this political action committee, if, you know, you guys are secure and you know where your money's going. I'd also question, you know, the folks who are custodians of this money right now. How responsible are they? And, you know, what confidence do you have in them right now?
Okay. Tessa, your paper broke the story on this. It seemed to get really good traction across the state. Gay House, you know, your publisher, they published it across the state. It got a lot of retweets. Why does it resonate so much with readers?
Well, I think first, anytime you have a scam that originates in Nigeria, I mean, come on, it goes back to the stereotype of the Nigerian prince and how you don't fall for it. You don't give them your bank account info. But it's kind of absurd. It's how did this large volume of money disappear, essentially, with so little oversight? You know, these places were so obscure, seemingly unrelated to Jacksonville. You know, where was the paper trail? Who was looking out for that? Why did they not verify they were speaking to the person they thought they were speaking to? I mean, just some very, very basic questions that you would like to think that people who are spending large amounts of money might know before they make transactions like that.
Okay, Ryan, dark money. That's something that's been talked about a lot in the last few years. It's something that comes into play here. These political committees, they're referred to as dark money committees. Explain the lack of transparency in these committees.
Well, so the first things first is that, of course, the phrase dark money, a lot of these political operatives, these people running these PACs and the politicians themselves would take issue with that characterization in this case, because you can sort of track where the money is going. Now, you don't know exactly who the donations are coming from, but you can see when it's transferred back and forth and the consulting that it pays for. But back to Tessa's point in the original question that you asked her, the reason why this resonates is because of that issue of dark money, and because it raises more questions, right? How many other times has this happened? This was almost a full year ago, and we're just finding out about it now because of Nate Monroe at the Times Union, who said yesterday, you know, this brings up questions for the entire apparatus. Who's controlling this? These PACs? How much oversight is over these PACs? You know, how much? You know, who's watching this money, and where is the money coming from and going? If you can wire that much money for consulting fees or for restaurants or for lodging in another state without even thinking twice about it, just with a simple phone call and not even verifying who the person is on the other line, I think citizens of this state are going to ask themselves the question, how often does this happen, you know, here in Florida and across the country?
And that we just don't know about it.
And that we just don't know about it, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, the donors to these committees, it should be pointed out, are not normal people, are they, Fred? I mean,
not by any stretch of the imagination.
Who's giving to these committees, and what do they want?
Well, I mean, this is all about trying to, as everything else, it's a bit about influence, but it's also about controlling the narrative, and that's why this kind of money goes in. It's controlling, it helps to control the narrative. You can almost do it blindly. Nobody has to know who's doing it right now. We, on the national scene, we have unknown donors contributing to the campaign to get the new justice on the Supreme Court. Nobody knows who's contributing money to control the narrative, so they can tell people what they should know about this justice. It's no different here now on the local level. We are really dealing in huge amounts of money, and we don't know who is funding it. And you use offices like this one to do it, to run the money through. And it's just amazing to anybody to think that you know, somebody like this could get snookered for more than $100,000 and not know it. Simply because they didn't have caller ID. But even if we have caller ID, who pays attention to it?
Well, to Fred's point, yeah. Look at how easy it was to recoup some of that money. They didn't recoup all of it, but they used another PAC to pass through money back, about $90,000. So they're about, what, $30,000 out, because it was a total of $120,000. But look at how easy it was for them to, quote-unquote, return the money to the donors in the first place. That's incredibly easy to move money back and forth, large sums of money, money that some people don't ever see even after a yearly salary. I mean, it could take years for someone to even earn that much amount of money, much less have it in their bank account.
Well, they were fortunate that it happened so quickly. I mean, that the call came in from the real person and they were able to get it very quickly. I mean, that was the fortunate part about this. You can, you know, make a little mini movie out of this. The fact that things happened so fast and you were able to, because how many times we look at that stopwatch and on a movie and the money just runs into the account at zero and they got it and the guy's going, okay, you can have your baby back, you know, that sort of thing. So they were fortunate that it happened this quickly. In many cases, it doesn't happen. They don't get the information as quickly, and the money is, in fact, lost.
Dave, I want to get you back in here for a second. 549-2937 for calls on this. Dave, what can $120,000 buy in a local campaign?
Oh, man. I mean, that's TV ads. That's, you know, radio ads. That's, you know, mailers. That is, you know, hosting parties. That's a huge chunk of money for most candidates. I think Mayor Lenny Curry has shown us in his, you know, run that's just, you know, a month of fundraising. I mean, less than a month of fundraising, right? Obviously, as you've been covering pretty aggressively. I think for every reporter in Florida that covers politics or government, I think you should be looking into this issue to see if this has happened to other candidates and their PACs. Because I'm going to say that, you know, this maybe isn't the first or the last candidate that this has happened to. Obviously, they got one through, so they're trying with others as well.
Yeah, I mean, Tessa, I mean, here's an issue that doesn't get pointed out too much. The fact that the treasurer is from Sarasota. Mm-hmm. You know, he's accounting from Venice, Florida, South Florida. I mean, so you've got statewide committees. This is a statewide political committee. Why does a Jacksonville mayor need a statewide political committee?
I mean, it's all part of the political operation, the political machine, right? Like you find the person who can do the job for you, and this person is prominent and known for doing this kind of work. You know, I think when all is said and done for the mayor and, you know, his reelection campaign over this, this is I think only going to come down to a minor embarrassment. I mean, clearly he's not hurting for cash. His campaign is not hurting for cash. His challengers are. And so this is something that will, you know, be embarrassing. We're going to make the Nigerian prince jokes. People are going to laugh about it. They're going to want to know, how could this happen? But at the end of the day, he is still flush, and that is what is going to help his campaign. Like, that's truly, I think, what's going to stick with people.
And they're going to say, to Fred's point, that, you know, we got this quick. We caught it real quick. We, you know, the investigation started, and, you know, unless someone would have reported it, it wouldn't have been a story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting take. I want to move on here, and we got a lot of stuff to get to today. 549-2937 for your calls. Another political happening this week. Governor Rick Scott chose a Republican and a Democrat to replace indicted and suspended Jacksonville City Councilors Katrina and Reggie Brown. This news was first reported on Monday by the Jacksonville Daily Record ahead of the actual announcement. David Cotton had the scoop there. The Republican, Terrence Freeman. He's replacing Reggie Brown in District 10. That's a 19% Republican district. Fred, are there any optical issues with Terrence Freeman taking over District 10?
There are a tremendous amount of optical issues with this. I mean, on face, for the folks who are in that district and in that area, it came off as a bit of an insult, to say the least.
Just a bit.
I mean, the only thing that the governor, and we know, of course, the governor did make this selection. The governor doesn't know anything about District 10 in Jacksonville on the far north side. He's never even visited there, as far as I know. He's visited around it, but never there. We know that this selection was made here in Jacksonville, probably between, what floor is the mayor's office on? The fourth floor?
David, I want to get you in here because you had the story first.
Yeah.
When you heard about this story,
yeah.
What was that process like? I mean, obviously you have a trust but verify moment. You know,
absolutely.
So tell us about your process as a reporter.
Well, what was interesting about this is, I think I was under the impression at the time that the governor's office was going to, like, their announcement was like imminent.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of us, you know, when we have sources confirm things to us before an actual announcement is made, I think there's a bit of a, you know, hold your breath moment. And hopefully, you know, you're not wrong. You're putting yourself out there a little bit. But when it didn't come Tuesday morning, I'm not going to lie, I was a little nervous. I was like, okay, like, when are they going to go with this? Because, you know, those of us who cover the governor's office in just politics in general know that, like, the governor doesn't drop announcements at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday. He does it at 5 o'clock after, you know, the 5 o'clock news has started. And I sort of was expecting it to drop Tuesday, you know, Monday night. I think with both Terrence Freeman and Jacoby Pittman, you know, yesterday at City Hall.
Pittman got District 8.
Yeah, absolutely. She will step in for Katrina Brown. It was all smiles yesterday. I don't know if there was any anticipation of anybody coming to protest these selections, specifically Terrence Freeman in District 10. But, you know, you ask anybody yesterday and everything is all good, you know, except for those city council members who were not in attendance. And I'm sure they have a difference of opinion.
Right. Ryan, I want to get you in here on this. When you look at this particular appointment, what message do you think it sends to, you know, Jacksonville voters in general, people in District 10, you know, especially with the Freeman appointment? Do you think democracy is being served with this?
Well, I think if you're talking about the people from, there's a difference between looking at Jacksonville as a whole and the opinion on this election and looking at the northwest side and in District 10. If you talk to people in District 10, I spoke to a political consultant who's consulted on a lot of Democratic campaigns statewide and also here in Jacksonville, specifically for African-American candidates. And he kind of came out and directly told me on the record that he felt the only reason why, the only connection that Freeman has to that side of town is the fact that he's African-American. Mm-hmm. That's literally what he said. And he said that's the perception of a lot of people that I've spoken to in the community have said that that other than that, he doesn't have a connection to that side of town.
How insulting.
Yeah.
I mean, truly, how insulting to assume that all African-American people must have the same interests. I mean, that's truly an offensive. If that is the reason for the appointment.
I'm just saying that's the perception from those that I have talked to.
I think
from
that's everyone's
that district.
Perception.
Yeah, right. But I think it's not actually always said as directly and out loud as it is. But yeah, that's what they have told me. They said, we feel like he was chosen because he was African-American. And because he's Republican, and that's the reason.
Fred, I want to get you in here to talk about Jacoby Pittman, the less controversial pick. Jacoby Pittman replacing Katrina Brown, District 8. What ramifications do you think that has?
I think it probably has some good positive ramifications. She's well established here. She's and well known. And as many people, not just you could tell by the applause yesterday that she received after swearing in, and well liked. And she's contributed a great deal to the community, inside and outside of that. She's just a known entity. Achilles heel here would be that she's running a nonprofit agency that does receive public funds, and that makes her, in some people's eyes, somewhat beholden to the power structure. There'll be maybe some votes during the next 9 months that she'll have to recuse herself from. Right. But by and large, nobody's going to quibble about the Jacoby Pittman at all. I mean, she's just got all of the things you'd like to see. She's ran, of course, 2 times for the office for a city council and lost both times. This will be a good opportunity for her to have a leg up for a re-election bid, which I think everybody would expect from her.
549-2937 for calls. We had some glitches with the switchboard. Those glitches are resolved, so we definitely want you all to call in on these issues, all the others of the day. We've got some more city council election drama. It was a good week for that. Specifically, a legal challenge to a special election. David Taylor, a former Jacksonville City Council Republican candidate who has not been immune to controversy over the years, Google that if you want to, is taking legal action against the Duval County Supervisor of Elections. Taylor's charge is a special election in District 12, which only had one person file, Randy White, was not publicly noted in a publication of record. Ryan, you were at the press conference yesterday. Tell us a little bit about what you saw and what you think about this legal challenge.
Well, first of all, it was extremely, extremely hot out there. and it was an interesting selection to do a press conference at that time outside. But aside from that, I can set that bias aside and say that going through... So watching Taylor... it was clear that his remarks that he was making to us were quite prepared. That's right. One thing that I think all of us that were at the press conference noticed. He seemed to memorize a lot of lines, but he also seemed to, let's just say, take liberties with the particular piece of the statute that he was citing as his reason for this lawsuit. So for folks that don't know the intricacies or didn't read or hear about it yesterday, essentially what Taylor is saying is that there is a state statute, and there is a state statute that mandates 2 notices be put in papers of record at least 10 days before qualifying period to allow candidates who would like to run for a special election to know that the qualifying period is set to begin.
But those are state elections, correct?
Yeah. Well, that is a state statute. Now, here's the wrinkle, though, right? So the city charter and the state constitution, neither of those specify the need for this type of notice. However, there is a part in the city charter that says when practicable, okay, when practicable, state statutes will apply to all special elections and other elections that a city or municipality holds. So he's hoping that a judge will find that it was practicable to expect that these notices were put in the paper, thus making the calling for the special election that Mike Hogan did null and void, and they'll have to call another one. That's what a judge is going to have to find here.
Dave, why don't you jump in here? Florida Constitution, it says very little about local special elections. It just says notice has to be given to SOE and, you know, his or her consent obtained. Mike Hogan said that consent was obtained. There was, in fact, a city council, ordinance allowing the election to go through. Isn't that all that's required?
Yeah, I mean, that's what the stance is from both Mike Hogan and also, you know, the general counsel's office at the city. I forget who asked this, but somebody asked, when did you know Doyle was going to step down?
Right.
And he basically told us, I'd known for a while. Oh, okay. Well, so that should trigger, I need to try to go here. And we also found out yesterday that, David didn't email. You know, he didn't create that public record. He said he called a couple of times. He said he, I don't know if he said he had actually gone up to the supervisors of elections office to inquire about this. But needless to say, there were a few holes in the story yesterday when we were standing out there next to the 1,000-degree pavement.
Tessa, Fred, I want to get your thoughts. I mean, Tessa, you know, here's my question. You know, why didn't just run in 2019? You know, because 2019 qualifying runs until January. He could have gotten the campaign structure built up. You know, what would be the advantage in, you know, forcing special election issue?
Well, he's certainly getting attention now, isn't he? I mean, that would be my thought.
Such as a press stunt?
I don't know if I'd call it a stunt, but I mean, we're talking about it, and I'm sure that's probably a large part of the goal.
Yeah, but I mean, we're talking about something that nobody understands.
But I mean, we're using his name.
and again, aside from us in this room and a few other people, who knows who David Taylor is? Yeah. You know, you've got to go back and look at
it. The Florida bar knows.
Yeah, well, the Florida bar knows. But I mean, the voters out there who would supposedly go to the polls to vote for this are going to say, what, who, what? I mean, you know, this is an interesting, you know, sideline issue. It is good for his publicity. But again, it just comes down to, okay, so what do you want? You know, by the time you get through court, it'll be 2019 anyway. Yeah. You might as well go ahead.
This is also a reminder that, you know, anybody can file a lawsuit. Amen. That doesn't mean it's going anywhere.
Yeah, it's a civil lawsuit. You can do it any time, right? It's a civil lawsuit.
If you have $400, you can file a lawsuit.
Yeah. And interesting wrinkle too that, you know, any of y'all can jump in on. The lawyer for David Taylor in this is Neil Henrichsen. Neil Henrichsen, the former Duval Democratic Party chair. He's running for a state house down south of here. Are there any optical issues in Henrichsen representing a Republican here?
I mean, what was he doing in Jacksonville? I mean, yeah, that was interesting to see him yesterday. I don't know if I were him, I'd be standing right there next to him and, you know, standing next to a, you know, pretty conservative Republican in front of the supervisor of elections office.
Well, lawyers do that.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a client.
Yeah, I mean, but why would you take the case? I don't.
Because it gets paid.
Better call Neil.
You're right.
Well, okay, but he doesn't have to take the case. I don't know Mr. Henrichsen that well, but it does seem like, if you're a lawyer, you get to choose the cases you take. So why is he taking this one? I mean,
well, I'm going to take a call. we got Stanley from downtown. He wants to talk about the mayor appointing the Republican Terrence Freeman in the District 10. Stanley, you're on the air.
Yes, how you doing today, people? Everybody.
Good morning.
I'm appalled by the fact that the mayor and Bowman, city council president Bowman, made that decision. I'm appalled by that because that is a Democratic candidate who ran for that office and won that office. And for the mayor and city council president to put.
I think you're breaking up there. We got a bad connection. We got your point. It seems to be that you think there was a conspiracy between the mayor and City Council Bowman. You know, another fun fact, I believe Mr. Scott is running for City Council himself in 2019. You know, so does anybody think that was an actual conspiracy? I mean, David.
Yeah, I don't want to use the word conspiracy, but what I will say is a lot of people have told me, you know, there's several people who already lived in the district that were Democrats that could have easily have been selected and we wouldn't even be having this conversation.
Right.
And the fact that, you know, Terrence, you know, whether or not he knew he was going to be the selection or whatever, okay, if you're going to put your name in the hat for this seat, do yourself a favor and get a place to live over there just in case you're the selection, because now you've got
Two rooms?
Yeah, I mean, but and that was the news cycle this week, right? He all of a sudden he's not a resident.
But if you don't if you don't care, and that's what people looked at, if you don't really care about that, I mean, there's so many, Tessa, you mentioned optics. There's so many optics here, and we all know how we feel about it down south here. First of all, you ain't from here. That's first thing. Ain't from Jacksonville. First of all, when you come to Jacksonville, you don't move to the side. If you're looking at politics, you look to the side of town where you can have a reasonable chance of getting elected. He ran once over there, and I think against Jason Fisher, lost that race. Over there in Arlington, lost that. He's worked for several jobs, and, you know, this one, but he's maintained a position in the Republican Party, so he becomes what they would like to see over here on the north side. And that is the one of the big rubs you have here about this thing. You place somebody in here who you know, who you want to have in that district. And that is a big insult.
When I spoke to Mr. Freeman, the one question that I had for him was, okay, so you had to put your name in the running for this. This is in that way, it's very similar to an election. You have to decide that you want that position. So I asked him the simple question of why? Why did you put your name in the running? And his answer was, well, I worked at a private Christian school, and it was adjacent to the district, and a lot of people that I taught or that I interacted with, a lot of the students actually come from that district and that side of town. And so I had conversations with some of these people, and that's what got me to run. I think for some people, again, going back to the optics, that seems like a little bit of a bizarre or at least slightly strange of reason for deciding to make such a big decision like running for a district that you don't currently live in.
Yeah.
And so I think to the caller's point, people are going to ask themselves the question, who really pushed him to put his name in the running? Who spoke to him about running for or about, you know, putting his name in to be selected for that position in District 10? I think that's the question that people are still asking.
Well, I mean, what we know is clear. I mean, that he worked formerly for now President Bowman as council aide. He worked on the Chamber of Commerce in the past, and he's a member of the Republican Party. And we know who heads the Republican Party, if not empirically here in Duval County, and who would push that, and who would have something to gain by getting someone in a seat in which they really will have to be beholden to the people who put them there. I mean, that's the issue here. Everybody has to look at what exactly is he going to be doing over the next 9 months. He says he's going to have a town hall meeting.
I want to get another caller in here. We got Mark from downtown. Mark, you're on First Coast Connect. What's on your mind regarding city council appointments?
Thank you. I just want to say that I find it very hard to believe that now Councilman Terrence Freeman wants District 10 to think that he is now living in a two-bedroom home.
Two bedrooms in a home, actually.
Exactly. But my point is, he expects us to believe that he's moved his family into someone else's home that he's renting, two rooms with a family of six, when he's coming from Mandarin in a 3,000-square-foot home that he just bought last year. I think it's insulting to District 10. I think it's insulting the voters for him to actually think that they believe that. And the whole process that the governor chose to appoint someone who is a Republican, who ran 2 years ago, who has a record of being very conservative, that's being backed by the NRA and traditional Republican voters, that's the type of person that the people in District 10 would want as their representative.
Hey, thanks for calling. Tessa, I want to get your thoughts on the living six people in two rooms. Is that plausible to you?
Sounds more miserable than any college dorm I ever lived in. I want to go back to a point that I made earlier when I said it was insulting to assume that all African-American people have, you know, a common outlook. I don't mean that as a disrespect to the person who made that comment. I mean that it is disrespectful to the people in that district. Quite frankly, I think it's disrespectful to Mr. Freeman. People who live within a community know the needs of that community best. And to assume that because they are African-American, that a man who lives in another part of town who also happens to be African-American, who has a different political party, who has a different outlook on things, to assume that they are just going to have that in common and that people will be satisfied with that pick, that's what's insulting. It's insulting to the people who live in that district, who deserve to have their voices, their concerns represented. And that's not going to come from someone. I mean, if they wanted a Republican in this district, the voters of that district would have chosen a Republican before, but they hadn't. And so to assume that just putting another African-American in that seat will be enough to satisfy people is, I think, deeply insulting.
Well, the interesting part about this, history is always a great thing. This will be the first time since consolidation that we will have had two black Republicans on the city council. And it's probably the because we hadn't had any black Republicans on the city council since the turn of the 20th century when we had when everybody was Republican for the most part back then. So it's historically a significant thing. It's interesting. It'll be interesting how the votes go when if anything comes up, for instance, on this Confederate monuments business. It'll be interesting to see what his thoughts are when that bill or that idea floats back to the surface.
Yeah, interesting. You mentioned monuments. That's our next topic. Obviously, Anna Brochet last year announced plans to inventory Confederate monuments, perhaps to remove them to museums or what have you. That legislation never materialized. She got a lot of pushback. However, Brochet, when she was headed out of office, had a task force on civil rights history, and 14 of its 27 members asserted last week in a memo that the process of discussion should be resumed. Hope McMath, Rodney Hurst, Richard Danforth, these are big names. They believe in merits discussion. The biggest Confederate monument is in Heming Park, a 62-foot monument of Confederate soldiers that loomed over the carnage of 1960s Axe Handle Saturday. Dave, do you think Jacksonville is ready for this monument discussion?
Well, whether or not they're ready, it's going to happen again. I think Anna, now that she is out of the spotlight of the presidency, will probably make that another priority this year. I mean, she's already introduced another bill to bring a piece of the lynching memorial to Jacksonville, the planks for the 7 documented lynchings that happened in Duval County. So she's not letting this die. And I think she was criticized a little bit by, you know, her political operatives who said, you know, she doesn't finish, she doesn't follow through on anything. But I think Anna is not someone who's going to just let this die at all.
Ryan, what are you seeing in City Hall?
Well, shortly before the last meeting of the Civil Rights History Task Force, which, by the way, it's not clear if everyone on the task force signed that letter.
About
half of them signed it. There was some disagreement in that last meeting whether or not they should muddy the water, so to speak, with this call, because they were afraid of the political ramifications that some of their other recommendations would be tainted by this call to remove the monuments or to do something with the monuments. But anyway, when I spoke to Anna, this is 2 or 3 days before the last task force meeting, she told me that she had basically given up on that discussion, that she had felt that the people of Jacksonville had, the majority of Jacksonville had spoken, and that they were either in favor of quote unquote contextualizing the monuments or just keeping it the way it is as now. Now, when she filed that bill, or when she was workshopping the bill to bring the lynching plank or lynching memorial from Alabama to Jacksonville, that museum for peace and justice in Alabama has a lynching plank for every county that has documented lynchings in it, and the whole kind of symbolic reasoning for that is so that counties can come back and claim their painful history. And to Anna, that was important. When I spoke to her, she said it wasn't directly correlated to her Confederate monument discussion. However, if you read the bill and if you speak to her about what she envisions as the placement for that, she wants that not only in Heming Park, not only on a big pedestal. She wants it in a position to where it can be clearly seen from the steps of City Hall. That's in the bill. That's mm-hmm. what she wants. So it's clear that what she's trying to do is saying, well, if people are going to be against removing the monuments and I can't really push that through, well, what I will do is I will take something that is a reminder of the painful history and what the Jim Crow South meant to African Americans in our city, and I'll make sure that people won't be able to ignore that.
Okay. I want to move on really quickly to body cameras. The body camera program, it was a big deal when it was launched. There was a pilot program, and now the program is on pause. Action News Jax started asking about the pilot program on Sunday because no officers wearing body cameras during an officer-involved shooting over the weekend, fatal shooting. They tried multiple vendors. We have some sound from Sheriff Mike Williams. Is it ready to go?
Keep in mind, there's never been a camera on a policeman until we started it. Until we started it with, you know, this pilot and kicking off the camera program. So anything that happens before we roll the cameras out is the way really it has always been. You know what I mean? I can't really fix that piece. So what we can do is move forward with the program, and we're right on track with that.
Tessa, Fred, I want to get you in here on this. Tessa, on the body camera issue, did you find the sheriff's comments there convincing? I mean, should people be worried specifically if something happens the next few months before to get the cameras deployed, which will be this fall, supposedly?
I think that it's good that we're talking about this now. You know, it's something that had kind of fallen out of the news for a little while. It was good that we had a checkup, that we know the progress of how this is going, because that's how we hold people accountable, right? Like, they say they're going to do something, and then we follow up and we see if it's being done or not. So I think that this is going to reignite interest in this issue. We've got, you know, kind of a timeline on record now. And so that's where we have to keep watching to see how things go from here.
Fred, do you think the sheriff has credibility in his body camera issue based on what's happened so far?
Well, the mere fact that he's agreed to it early on and has, of course, run the first test, which is, I think, in most eyes would be a reasonable thing to do to see how well they're going to do it, what kind of camera they're going to have, where they're going to wear it, is reasonable. I think the thing that's a bit disconcerting, and of course the general public doesn't know this, is that the police union is actually the ones who are going to make that decision as to what their members are going to wear. And the whole, as always with these police community discussions, the community is shut out. Mm-hmm. Of what that's going to be. There is no group of civilians who are working with between the sheriff and the union to see how this is going to play out. What we have is a discussion between the sheriff and his employees about what they're going to do to abide by the public concern about having these cameras. And that's the issue here that's not being discussed. The union is the one that's making decisions about it. They've agreed, well, let's wear them all the time, says the union president. Let's keep them on, except after we have an incident. If we have an incident, let's shut them off. Mm-hmm. And we're not hearing that. It's not the issue of the cameras. It's the issue of how they're going to be worn and when they're going to be on, turned on and off. And that discussion, the public is being shut out of that. And that's the biggest problem that continues to be an issue for this sheriff and the union, unfortunately, that he represents.
Ryan, Dave, I want to get you in here. Ryan, what are your thoughts on this camera delay?
Well, like Fred says, it's going to be up to the negotiations between the union and, you know, their members' employer. And what happens in those negotiations is exactly what Fred says. We'll see when those cameras can be shut off and who controls the information afterwards. Reporters that have experience dealing with any police department or sheriff's office know that it's not just a matter of having the information. It's what's in law and policy for what happens with the information after it's recorded. So it could also be an issue of deciding that the officers have full control or more control over the information that gets recorded on their lapel than let's say other police departments around the country that have these cameras. Now, remember, these cameras are coming. They have a federal grant for them. That money is there. And that's what the Times Union reported. Ben Konark of the Times Union reported. That was his angle in his story, was that the money is there and they still haven't, you know, figured out a way to implement these cameras.
I think it's very interesting. I think it's very interesting that nobody really knew that they weren't wearing cameras right now. I think people assumed, okay, there was a police-involved shooting. There's got to be footage because they've been running this pilot program. And I'm a little concerned that JSO didn't get out in front of this and say, hey, our pilot program ended. By the way, this is when we're going to implement this again. And, you know, just be a little bit more upfront with it, because then you avoid a controversy altogether, I think.
Okay. Speaking of controversy, you got one big news item in. Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader, is coming to town for Representative Al Lawson, our congressman from Tallahassee, who's running against former Jacksonville Mayor Alvin Brown. Pelosi's going to be at Lawson's headquarters Friday afternoon. Today, I'll be covering it. And he's going to have a fundraiser with Pelosi afterwards. Meanwhile, Alvin Brown's got endorsements from Shad Khan, former Mayor Jake Godbold, etc. When we look at this race between Lawson and Brown, Brown's going to have to stack up votes in Jacksonville. Fred, I want to go to you here. What are you seeing with Brown's campaign in terms of Jacksonville outreach, and is it enough?
Well, he is certainly going around shoring up all of the problems that he had coming out of the mayor's office. I think he's gotten former Mayor Jake Godbole to give him an endorsement there. He's gotten a lot of the local, quote, folks to do it. I think the local Democratic Party, if looking at how their meetings are stacking up is any indication, he seems to have a favorable ratings there. His biggest problem continues to be, of course, among the largely African-American voters in the Democratic Party, that business with Barack Obama from when he was mayor. But he seemed to have gotten his ground game together. He's being upfront about the issues that he has, and he's now apparently willing to engage Al Lawson by calling for these debates. And obviously, they don't expect very much out of whatever Republican opponent he may have in the general election by bringing Nancy Pelosi in here, because obviously any Republican is going to run Nancy Pelosi on their campaign ads. So apparently, Representative Lawson is not worried about that. But it is shaping up to be a sort of toss-up for August 28th. It's really a toss up at this point. Lawson's got Tallahassee. Brown will be pretty good in getting Jacksonville, but the votes in between could go either way.
And I think it's also important to note that Lawson is bringing Pelosi to Brown's backyard. Mm. Not only are you bringing a, you know, probably one of the most well-known, you know, Washington lawmakers to endorse you, you're doing it in your opponent's backyard. I think that says something to sort of how this race is shaped up, the comments in between each other. I mean, Al Lawson, what was the first thing he told us, AG? You know, I want to retire him. He's looking for a job.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, Tessa, I want to ask you a question. You know, obviously this isn't totally your beat, but, you know, with this Lawson-Brown race, the Times Union hasn't covered much of it. Do you think there's a possibility that people just aren't aware of this campaign?
I think that could happen. In regards to the Times Union, I mean, I think people are well aware that we just have fewer resources and fewer reporters and less time to dedicate to things like this.
There should be a union.
I agree. Says the girl wearing a Times Union Guild button.
Well, they did put two bars in today's Times Union about the visit today. So there's two nice little bars and about 10 paragraphs about it in today's Times Union. So at least they did tell everybody she's coming.
Right. And I would just encourage people. I mean, look at this wonderful media roundtable. There are plenty of opportunities to get your news from a lot of different sources in Jacksonville.
But we're not all news here. We also do things that are crowd pleasing, such as our Only in Florida segment. Finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. There's never a shortage of material, and this week's no exception. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. From Vero Beach, a Florida man stopped for drunk driving denies he was actually drinking while driving. He only drank while stopped at traffic signals and stop signs.
Technicality.
Earl Stevens of Vero Beach was approached on June 27th by a police officer after a woman called 911 saying he had bumped her bumper numerous times while waiting in a McDonald's drive-thru lane. Eat healthy. The driver smelled of alcohol, was slurring his words, according to the officer, and he had a bottle of Jim Beam beside him.
Makes my head ache.
Hey, the McRib is back.
Drinking it straight.
Should have Maker's Mark.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, Fred. But when pressed if he was drinking while driving, Stevens said no. He further explained that he was not drinking while the car was moving, but only while he stopped for stop signs and traffic signals. He was arrested and charged with drunk driving and driving without a license.
Oh, it's that last part that got him.
Miscarriage of justice there. And here's one from close to home, but it reminded me of my kinfolk. A St. Joe's a St. Johns County, Florida man has been jailed on a charge of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon without intent to kill. What was that weapon? A tractor. Ooh. Howell Morris, 72 years old, chased down his neighbor on a tractor last month. Tessa, that's it for today. I want to thank our roundtable. David Cotton, Fred Matthews, Ryan Bank, Tessa Duvall. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for
thank you.
Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours, available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. A company's cell phone policy can protect your employees and your bottom line.
Our distracted driving presentation for the workforce can help.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
On the next Fresh Air, our interview with Tab Hunter, a Hollywood heartthrob who later came out as gay. He died Sunday at age 86. Also, our interview with the late cartoonist John Callahan, who had paraplegia after an auto accident when he was 21, a condition he joked about in his cartoons. He's played by Joaquin Phoenix in the new movie, Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, why 1,000 students enrolled in a college class on happiness. A Yale professor who teaches the course offers advice for seeking happiness in these stressful times. Plus, as the World Cup finals arrive this weekend, we'll look at the psychology and strategy behind soccer flops and fakes. All on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
World Cup fans are holding their breath, but the world gave a sigh of relief after a youth soccer team escaped a cave in Thailand. Also, did we see a new world order take shape at NATO? And what can we expect when Trump and Putin meet on Monday? The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, we have a musical guest for you, Crescendo Amelia. It all started when drummer and producer Frank Basile posted a message on Craigslist titled, "Want to play in a big band?" Dennis LeGreen was one of the first to answer bands. Together, he built the band, which is now known as Crescendo Amelia, a crowd pleaser across the First Coast. They performed across the region with a diverse group of clients. The annual Christmas show in Amelia Island always sells out, and they also have recently produced a music video, full-length holiday CD. They are performing tonight at 7:30 at the Craft Athletic Club in Fernandina Beach. To talk about the band now, we are joined by band leader Dennis LeGreen, vocalist Mara Lovequist. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
All right. I want to ask you all some questions about this band. When did you all get started?
So we got started about 2013 when I answered that Craigslist ad, and it's been going really fast ever since.
So, was that when you went on Craigslist looking for a band, did you expect something like that?
Absolutely not. I was just trying to get back into playing, and it was a real gem to find that.
And Mara, you have an amazing voice.
Thank you.
Yeah. So how did you get involved?
I was friends with Frankie's wife, Shannon, and I invited them to a musical that I was in that I happened to get a part in. And after the show, Frankie came up to me and said, I didn't know you could sing. I was like, well, me either. You call that singing, you know, that's right. Okay. He said, well, you know, I have a band, right? I was like, yeah, I know you have a band. He goes, well, would you like to maybe try come down and sing a couple tunes? I'm like, yeah, all right, sure. And so that's how it snowballed for me, and it's been super fun. I didn't know I liked jazz as much as I did until I started in the band.
Well, we're going to hear one of your standards now. We're going to hear your version of Fever, which is a very a song that's been done by a lot of groups, but you have a unique take on it, so let's play it.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever when you kiss me, a fever when you hold me tight, a fever in the morning, a fever all through the night.
Sun lights up the daytime, moon lights up the night. I love it when you call my name, and you know I'm gonna treat you right. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning, fever all through the night. Everybody's got fever. That's something you all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago.
Juliet. Juliet, she felt the same. But when he put his arms around her, he said, Julie, baby, you're my flame. Thou giveth fever. When we kiss, a fever with thy flaming you. Fever, I'm a fire, a fever, yeah, I burn forsooth.
Captain Smith and Pocahontas,
say what,
had a very mad affair.
Yes, they did.
When her daddy tried to kill him, he said, Daddy, oh, don't you dare, it gives me fever. With his kisses, fever when he holds me tight. Fever, I'm his missus. Daddy, won't you treat him to my story, and here's the point that I have made. Chicks are born to kick a fever, be it Fahrenheit or centigrade.
They give you fever when you kiss them, a fever if you live and learn. A fever till you sizzle, what a lovely way to burn. What a lovely way to burn. What a lovely way to burn.
Man, dig those horns. Where are y'all playing? You're playing obviously tonight in Fernandina Beach, the Craft Athletic Club, but what about the rest of the summer?
So we have another dance on August 10th. It'll be a decades themed dance. So it's going to be dressed as your favorite decade.
Super excited about that one.
And tell us a little bit more about that. You've got this thing tonight, you know, and you've got an August 10th series dance, the dress of your favorite decade. You're going to have arrangements to Daft Punk's Get Lucky and Uptown Funk. What kind of reaction do you get from songs like that?
I think we get a really big smile from our guests because they get to hear the music they love.
Okay, we got to wrap up. That's our program. Thanks to all of our guests, all of our callers, show's producer, Kevin Mearshart, Michelle Corum on the board. The show's theme composed and performed by Peter Chefchik. Have questions or comments about First Coast Connect? Email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm A.G. Gankarski from Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. Melissa's back on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.